Good morning. The panel is now ready for the third case set for oral argument today. It appears that both attorneys are ready. I will call the case. The next case is number A22-0892, Stephen Woodkey and others versus Travis Braca and others. And we are conducting this oral argument via the Zoom video platform. The procedures are essentially the same. Each party will have 15 minutes for its principal argument. The appellant's attorney will have then after that 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. You should be able to see the time clock on your screen if you're using the gallery view or some other similar format. While you are not making your argument, we would appreciate your muting your microphone. Counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and your client or clients, and you may begin your argument.
Justin Anderson on behalf of Stephen Woodkey, Derek Woodkey, Darren Woodkey, as well as Lauren Woodkey. May it please the court, Ms. Schmidt, good morning. In appellant's view, this appeal and the path that it takes hinges on the definition of an action in a proceeding. And whether this matter involves one action, which was commenced by the appellants serving their declaratory judgment action, or whether there are two actions that were commenced, the declaratory judgment action and respondent's counterclaim. If the former, we believe that the analysis falls squarely on a subject matter jurisdiction claim, and if the latter, subject matter jurisdiction might not apply, and we would address the issues with regard to our response to that counterclaim, as well as the court's determination of summary judgment. Now, in the briefing, respondent appropriately noted that the subject matter jurisdiction issue was not brought up at the district court level. However, our position is that Minnesota law is abundantly clear that lack of subject matter jurisdiction may be raised at any time, even for the first time on appeal. That's Metz G versus Central Neighborhood Improvement Association, 649 Northwest 2nd, 488, a Court of Appeals case from 2002. And this is because, as the Supreme Court observed in Tischer versus Housing and Redevelopment Authority, that subject matter goes to the court's authority to hear the matter at all. It cannot be waived and it cannot be conferred. Accordingly, it's our view that subject matter jurisdiction is and will always be before this court, regardless of what happened in the proceedings of below. And this is particularly true in the instant matter because on April 4th, this court, which was after the oral arguments on the motion for summary judgment, this court issued Glen Eden of Edinburgh, which held that not only did Rule 504A of the Rules of Civil Procedure apply to a complaint filed after 1 year in service, but it also applied to answers. If you look at the rule, it indicates that any action that is not filed within 1 year of commencement against any party is deemed dismissed with prejudice against all parties unless the parties sign a stipulation. So on its face, any action refers both to the complaint and any answer and counterclaim that might have resulted from that complaint, and commencement necessarily relates back to service of the complaint. With that definition, we would also note that the action as a whole has always been about appellant's rights to utilize an easement area, which I'll
read. Mr. Anderson, so if you're right on the subject matter jurisdiction, and you know Glen Eden says what it says, then presumably both your complaint and the answer and counterclaim are dismissed with prejudice. But that is that correct?
That is correct, Your
Honor. Is that what you really want? I mean, then how are your clients going to get relief?
So there is an alternative.
I mean, could you then, are you telling me you could start from scratch and everybody, by God, will file, you know, their stuff probably within 1 day of being served? But I mean, can you do that?
I'm not saying that. No, I don't think that we can, you know, because.
Is that what you want? If this applies and Glenn Eden says what it says, it's a little different because this is an answer and counterclaim. But, you know, let's say the sake of argument, you know, that's still an answer is an action, whether it's got a counterclaim or it's not. Then this just goes away forever, right? And your clients aren't going to get an easement.
We do have a path forward, and I don't know that if my clients don't get an easement. Our position is that we have an easement. That is the nature of the dispute.
There'd be no way. And yes, I definitely understand your clients say they have an easement. But how would you, if both lawsuits are gone, how would you be able to assert that right?
We would necessarily need to petition the local township for a cartway, which is permitted. I don't have the statute in front of me, but any piece of land that is greater than 5 acres in area, which is landlocked, needs to have access. And there is a specific proceeding that would allow us to gain access by that way. Although not part of the record, I can tell you that one of my clients and his wife purchased a 40-acre tract that adjoins the township road.
Let's not get into things that are not on the record, because everyone's going to get mad. I guess one thing I find sort of just interesting is, and you tell me if I'm wrong. If the complaint, if I'm their defendant, and I see that, you know, you're about the a plaintiff is about to blow the deadline on the 1 year filing. Why on earth would I want to help you by filing my answer, within a year of the complaint being served? Why would I want to revive your lawsuit? Who in his right mind would want to do that? And Glenn Eden says what it says. I get it, but I just can't imagine for the purpose of asserting a counterclaim, I would risk the action not being dismissed with prejudice. So I guess from a tactical standpoint, how does that make sense? Why would you want to do that? If wouldn't you rather just want the lawsuit to die?
I think it depends on the circumstances and the nature of the action.
Well, about the circumstances where I've got a counterclaim, but by God, I'm not going to, why would I want to revive your lawsuit? I guess that's, even if I've got a counterclaim, who cares if I have a counterclaim in a lawsuit that doesn't exist?
If there were certain provisions that would allow you to recover fees, cost disbursements, things of that nature, that may be relevant.
Well, then maybe I'd file a new lawsuit because yours is dead. Do you sort of see the lie? I'm just trying to get a handle on the logic of all of this, because one thing that does concern me is I'm not sure Glenn Eden thought of this situation. Maybe it did. I don't know. It's a very short opinion. It says what it says. And I'm just concerned that this situation is a little different. Why should I not have those concerns? And then, tough, it's dismissed and it's dismissed.
Because a party may want something adjudicated on the merits instead of just dismissed with prejudice without any action whatsoever.
Fair enough.
As in this case, as the record disclosed, it wasn't as if the declaratory judgment action was filed and nothing happened. There was discovery, there was mediation, things of that nature. The important point, I think, is that, they're couched under two different theories, one a declaratory judgment action, the other quiet title, but in one sense, they are the same action and the same proceeding. And there was no pleading in this matter that was filed. It's clear that the complaint was served on December 18th, and it's similarly clear that there was nothing that was filed in this lawsuit until December 28th, of 2020, which blows the 1 year. And, you know, whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent in
The reason. I'd like to sort of get maybe to a little bit of the substance of this, apart from, you know, Glendiden and
sure.
1 year. So if it's true that your case, that the complaint is gone because it wasn't filed within a year, they then file their answer and counterclaim and it's served when it's served. You then file everyone calls it an answer. I really think it's supposed to, I thought it was a reply to a counterclaim, but not an answer to a counterclaim. But whatever it is, it's a responsive pleading. You asserted, you know, four defenses, and then at summary judgment, you know, we got into easement by necessity, et cetera, et cetera. I'm at a loss to understand how you can go beyond your four defenses in your reply to a counterclaim if indeed the complaint has been dismissed. I don't see how you get to, I don't see, speaking for myself only, not my treasured colleagues, how you get to kind of, oh no, everything's back now, you know, and we're back to square one. Why am I wrong on that, Mr. Anderson?
Well, I don't know that we're asserting that our complaint is revived or, as the district court below said, bootstrapped. The complaint was simply attached, it appears to me that the district court struck a portion of our answer or our reply, if that is what it should have been nominated as, without any request to do so. And the court did criticize, the matter of interpretation and what the documents mean, the nature of easement by necessity. We claim simply an easement, and I haven't found where those are affirmative defenses.
But I mean, in a reply, you asserted these four defenses in reply to the counterclaim. And then at summary judgment, and one of them was not statute of limitations. You would not be allowed to, at summary judgment, in a responsive pleading, say, oh, and by the way, this is also, the statute of limitations has expired, if you didn't assert that in your reply to the counterclaim. Would that be a fair statement?
It is not specifically referenced, but my understanding is that this court has long held that specific legal theories do not need to be stated if the pleadings contain factual notice of the claim and a request for relief or both. For example,
no, but I'm sure we've said what we ever said, but I mean, I think there's also case law that says affirmative defenses have to be pled with particularity, and presumably statute of limitations would be something that you've got to plead with particularity. I mean, would you agree with me on that, Mr. Anderson?
Per statute of limitations, yes. I don't know that we asserted that. But the very nature of a quiet title action is an acknowledgement by one party that there are adverse claims, in this case made by my clients, and the nature of the relief requested is for the court to adjudicate those adverse claims and the rights of the parties. And that all comes down to what the documents say. Respondents in their arguments suggested, what findings of fact were not identified. And I think what the court missed is the long-held principle that all facts and reasonable inferences when considering whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact must be viewed in a light most favorable to the non-moving party. So if we look at, the history of this case, Ms. Strand, who owned all of this property in the very beginning, had 160 acres in rural Stevens County, Minnesota, which primarily consisted of valuable tillable farmland, but there was also a building site. And as she was preparing to sell that building site, she had Nyberg Surveying prepare a certificate of survey. That survey was transmitted 4 days before she signed a deed to Norman and Joyce Meyer, who are the respondents' predecessors in title. So the survey comes out. Nyberg indicates then that the legal description should be Lot A, subject to an easement for access over Lot B. And so it was clear that that Lot B was going to be intended to be used to access the other properties that she was going to retain. And now when the Meyer deed, which again is signed 4 days after the survey was completed, it purports to transfer all of Lot A, which again is inclusive of Lot B, yet strangely she also conveys an easement over Lot B, which is superfluous language had she not intended on retaining Lot B. The deed from the Myers to the Brackas simply conveys the Nyberg survey, which again by letter he explained should be Lot A, subject to an easement over Lot B. The only clarity comes as to Ms. Strand's intent when she enters into a contract for deed with my clients, where she conveys the 160 acres, less Lot A, and also conveys an easement. I'm probably going to stop at this point and probably pick up on my additional arguments when my time comes.
Okay, if you wish, Mr. Anderson, you may continue with your during your rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself and your client and or clients, and you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Laura Schmidt, appearing on behalf of my clients Travis and Christina Bracca, respondents in this matter. They are also viewing this hearing with us this morning. Given all that's transpired in this matter, which you've read in both briefs, et cetera, it's worth examining what brought us to this point. So how did we get here? The answer to this question gives a great backdrop to the issues that the court's considering on this appeal, also somewhat enlightening as to what the arguments actually are really what appellant's arguments are actually trying to accomplish. So in short, it's respondent's position that we're here primarily because of three things. First, appellants failed to file their complaint, also known as the action for declaratory judgment, with the court within 1 year of serving it on my clients. Second, that appellants failed to properly plead affirmative defenses in response to my client's action against them. And then third, that on summary judgment at the district court, the facts were not in appellant's favor. So with the dismissal of appellant's action for declaratory judgment with prejudice and the district court's subsequent order granting summary judgment in favor of my clients, appellants found themselves in a precarious situation. They found themselves with no right, title, interest, estate, lien, or access easement in, over, or upon a portion of my client's property, the respondent's property, that they had claimed for some time that they had a right to utilize. But after those things, dismissal with prejudice, the summary judgment order, they didn't have that. Cue this appeal. Appellants raised three issues on appeal, and I'll address them in order. So first, contrary to appellant's assertion, the district court did in fact have subject matter jurisdiction over this case, and more specifically over respondent's counterclaim. I agree with Mr. Anderson that one of the primary issues here is what's an action, what constitutes an action for purposes of Rule 5.04A. So until this appeal, appellants had never challenged the district court subject matter jurisdiction over this case. Not once, not ever. One might wonder why. I know I do. If appellants believed the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction when respondents filed their counterclaim and they claim it's untimely, why did they let it get to the stage it got to at the district court? They could have brought a motion at any point after respondents filed their counterclaim. They could have made this argument in response to respondents' motion for summary judgment.
Well, Ms. Schmidt, I mean, in all fairness to Mr. Anderson, Glenn Eden had been released yet. So everybody was operating under a different assumption. I think you have very valid points, but I guess to get to the heart of it, what are we supposed to do now? It seems like Glenn Eden says, an answer is an action. And if you file that within 1 year of the complaint being served, it activates the complaint, and the complaint and answer are there. So does it extend to, well, if neither side does that? I mean, it seems like Glendon, as best as I can read it, says if the answer is filed within the 1 year of the complaint being served, everything is active. But does that also mean that if neither side files their complaint and answer within 1 year of the complaint being served, does that mean everything's gone, which would also be your answer and counterclaim? So is that what Glendon says?
No, in our opinion, it doesn't. In his argument, Mr. Anderson, in my opinion, our opinion, inappropriately said Glendon involved an answer and a counterclaim. It did not. It involved a complaint and an answer. And then we get to the nut of it, that is, what is an action? And so I've cited in my brief, et cetera, that an action. So
is it your position, Ms. Schmidt, a counterclaim is a separate action?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. What case is that?
There's not anything that I could find, admittedly.
So you'd like it to be this one?
I would. And I think to go to a point.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure. This case gives me a headache. Let me ask you this, Michelle. And I apologize for interrupting a lot. Let me shift to, do we have to get to all of that? And I understand Mr. Anderson would say, well, sure you do. Either you have subject matter jurisdiction or you don't. But assuming, even if we did, couldn't we just say, the affirmative, the defenses pled to your counterclaim fail as a matter of law, as the district court said, and they don't, and the counterclaim doesn't revive his complaint, and more importantly, you don't get to go beyond the four defenses you've alleged in the reply to a counterclaim when you're alleging new things. Now that we're at summary judgment, let me tell you the other three reasons. I mean, could we write an opinion that says, no matter what, that fails, I mean, on the merits? I mean, could we do that?
I believe Your Honors could do that.
How could we do that if we don't have subject matter jurisdiction? Would we assume that we do, for the sake of argument, and just say, even if we... if we do, it fails on the merits? I'm just thinking out.
Yep, I have two thoughts on that, Your Honor, and thank you for the question. So, I don't dispute that the general rule is that a party can raise subject matter jurisdiction at any time. I don't disagree with that. And that's why we're here. That's why we're entertaining it on this appeal. The question that I have is, general rules in the law and otherwise have exceptions. Those exceptions get established when there's a unique case such as this one that Your Honor mentioned previously, probably wasn't contemplated, that this would be a complaint, an answer with a counterclaim, et cetera. And so I believe this case calls for an exception to that general rule that subject matter can be raised the first time on appeal. I also believe that Mr. Anderson and his clients submitted multiple times to the jurisdiction of the court that this matter could somehow be determined by the district court. Again, at this point, if we said that there's no subject matter jurisdiction, that is highly prejudicial to my clients when it could have and should have been argued for the district court to make a decision on. And presumably Judge Beckman would have. If this was an argument that, and I understand Glendon Eden hadn't come into existence yet, if the subject matter issue is there now, it was there when we filed our counterclaim. And so by continuing, and I'm gonna be frank and honest with the court, I don't think that appellants would be arguing a lack of subject matter jurisdiction if the court had denied the motion for summary judgment. That's why I believe this issue is, well, a red herring. The nut of this is that the court did not err, that the appellants didn't properly defend this case. So this to me is an issue that needs to be addressed, certainly, but because the general rule deserves an exception in this case, and then also because the appellant submitted to this jurisdiction on this to the point of getting an order that was not in their favor on summary judgment.
Ms. Schmidt, yes. I have a question about whether Glen Eden is really a jurisdictional case. The opinion does not make any reference to subject matter jurisdiction, I believe, having skimmed it again. The effect of Rule 5.04 is that an action is deemed dismissed with prejudice, which seems to be, you know, a determination on the merits rather than an abdication of any judicial authority to decide the matter. Is it in your research or preparation, did you consider that issue, and do you have any other authorities to show us relevant to that issue?
I don't, other than my thoughts, Your Honor, and I would like to reiterate a few things about the definition of action too, since it relates. But I did not find research that suggested that it was for sure a subject matter case. I professionally don't think it was. I think that it was a very different animal, but I think part of the issue of one of the underpinnings of this subject matter jurisdiction argument is that definition of an action. And an action defined by statute is any proceeding in any court of this state. And then there's dictionary definitions, they run the gambit, but one of them is a judicial proceeding whose purpose is to obtain relief at the hands of the court. A counterclaim is seeking to get relief from the court. This case is complicated because appellants didn't file their complaint action for declaratory judgment within that year. So we were bound to include that counterclaim. It's a compulsory counterclaim. We absolutely had to do it. So if they lost and so we lose it, that doesn't make any sense if that 504 says for some reason we have to file an affirmative action within their 1 year instead of our 1 year. And I'd say in Ellis and Doe, which I cited in my papers, the Supreme Court held that a more relevant definition of proceeding supports an interpretation that an affirmative pleading rather than a responsive pleading should be considered an action. An answer is solely responsive. You deny, admit to all the punch list of the complaint, whereas a counterclaim is very clearly affirmative. It is something that in this case had to be filed with the answer, but it is something different entirely, and it's an affirmative. So I would argue that respondent's counterclaim, which we were required to respond with, plead separately, but along with the answer, affirmatively asserted different claims, particularly because the appellant's claims were dismissed with prejudice. There is zero dispute that their claims were dismissed. So to say that my clients, who timely asserted their affirmative claim and filed it with the court, somehow goes poof along with theirs, doesn't make sense. And it certainly isn't supported by the opinion in Glen Eden. So if there's no questions, I'll just wrap a few things up here because I see my time ticking down. So just for maybe illustration of that, this is a new issue, that this is something that wasn't contemplated before, I'd note that in their own brief at page 12, appellants acknowledged that a separate action was commenced with service of respondents' counterclaim. They state, quote, respondents filed a counterclaim in its answer. This created a new cause of action in this litigation to which appellants were obligated to file an answer pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 7.01. Also, on page one, mind you, it's in their introduction, they say, respondents' counterclaim created a secondary cause of action. At the very least, this warrants looking at this deeper by this court. And if you don't mind, I'm going to move on to the other two issues. So I just highlight some things. We rely fully on our submissions. But I'll say two things. Several rules, as pointed out by the court, require a party to plead all of its defenses with particularity. And I would turn you to their action for declaratory judgment. In its very text, the only thing in that attachment to their answer says, in the prayer for relief, we ask the court to affirm that the plaintiff's absolute and equivocal, I believe they meant unequivocal, right to access and use Lot B. That's a statement. We are aware they're claiming that they have a right to be there. Zero legal theory articulating those other defenses. So our position is that they lost the right to bring any of those defenses up at the district court level. And then finally, Your Honors, we do not feel that the district court erred in its decision on granting summary judgment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Mr. Anderson, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Just a couple of things. If I misspoke and indicated that there was an answer and counterclaim in Glen Eden, I apologize. That is not accurate. Regardless of the affirmative defenses pled, I still go back to the general concept that the purpose of a quiet title action, and the court can look at the quiet title counterclaim, which is plainly pled, it has to adjudicate the respective rights of the parties. And the court omitted necessary findings of fact that were necessarily favorable to us. It is completely inconceivable that Ms. Strand would, as respondents encourage this court and the court found below, go through the hassle of having her property surveyed, retain agricultural property, and landlock herself without access. Even without the affirmative defenses, the court does need to figure out what Ms. Strand's intent was when she conveyed out. Needs to develop, a more sound reasoning. Judge Beckman in her order indicates that, here's what her intent was, but doesn't fully analyze the documents and what they intended. And that's not an affirmative defense. That goes to the heart and core of the issue in a quiet title action. I would note that on paragraph 10 of the appellant's answer to the counterclaim, they specifically put the interpretation of the documents at the forefront. The theory should have been of no surprise because Stephen Woodkey's request for admissions addressed all of those things that the district court below characterized as affirmative defenses. Paragraph 5, he explains that he was insured by Lowell Nelson, who not only drafted the initial deed from Ms. Strand to the Myers, but also the contractor deed between Ms. Strand and the Woodkeys, that they had access. The fact of a scrivener's error, ambiguity in the various documents is addressed in paragraphs 13, 14, and 15. And easement by necessity is addressed at paragraphs 8, 9, 11, and 13 of those requests. So we don't think that the court below did a sufficient job in making findings of fact and making them under the guiding principle that those facts and reasonable inferences are to be drawn in a light most favorable to us. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, I have a question for you, I guess similar to my question to Ms. Schmidt, and that is the Glen Eden opinion really about subject matter jurisdiction rather than something else. And it seems to me that the characterization of that issue could determine whether it's that's an issue that you can raise for the first time on appeal versus an issue that would be forfeited by not being raised earlier.
So if Glen Eden stands for the proposition that if no pleading is filed within 1 year of commencement of the action, and then that action is then by operation of the rule dismissed with prejudice, those matters cannot be relitigated again. So we do believe that it is directly related to subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay. It appears that there are no further questions for you. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And the court has one more oral argument today. We will take just a minute to make the transition to that case.